This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We talk with some reporters here in Northwest Indiana Media about the stories that they have covered, both online and in print in their printed publications. That will include today reporters from the Times of Northwest Indiana, Giles Bruce and Sarah Reese, from the LaPorte and the Michigan City newspapers, John Gard will join us. And we'll have Greg Tejeda from the Post-Tribune with us as well. And we have some interesting stories as well, too, from Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we take a look first at news on the health scene. And for that, we are turning to Giles Bruce, who covers Northwest Indiana health stories for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Giles, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out here with the story that you had on of interest. The number of them, in fact, all of them are very interesting, and one rather poignant story. We'll get to that one here shortly. But let's talk first about Community Hospital in Munster and the University of Chicago Medicine getting together for a very interesting partnership. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, well, they announced that they were partnering to treat high-risk pregnancies. Essentially, University of Chicago Hospital will provide maternal fetal medicine specialists in the hospital there. And what they do is, take care of moms who are having difficult pregnancies with, the testing and monitoring and labor and delivery and everything else. They'll also be available to see moms on an outpatient basis in Cherrville at the University of Chicago clinic there. So, both organizations are hoping that this will help prevent, those women from having to go to Chicago to get this kind of care, that they can get it right here in Northwest Indiana.
I know one of the doctors involved in the partnership is calling it a win-win situation. Explain how Dr. Martin Kelly feels about this.
I think he's referring to the fact of, like I just mentioned, that these moms would, to get this kind of specialized care before, would have to drive to a university hospital in Chicago, which is not easy for someone who is going through a difficult pregnancy to have to make that drive on a regular basis. So now these moms can get that care, get this care closer to home.
I guess this is, part of what Community Hospital is trying to do, an expansion. Of course, in recent months, they've been finishing up work on their surgery center, and they have it, in pretty much in operation now, too. And they've been doing a lot of other areas as well, too, to kind of beef up and make their services more available to Northwest Indiana residents that maybe they had been going to Chicago. This is interesting that they've got the University of Chicago Medicine involved in this specific project.
Yeah, and I'd say it's part of a larger trend our local hospitals trying to prevent residents from having to go to Chicago for care. We don't have any university teaching hospitals here, so there are some unique specialties that we do lack, but overall hospitals here are trying to kind of beef up their services to keep people in the area. There have been reports that Northwest Indiana residents spend, hundreds of millions to as much as $1 billion a year. Wow. On care outside of the region. So the healthcare providers are trying to keep that money locally. And one of the ways they're doing that is to partner with the Chicago hospitals to bring the services over here. Recently, Franciscan partnered with Rush University to provide orthopedic care at the Franciscan Hospital in Munster, and Franciscan's also partnered with the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago previously to have some of that institution's expertise here in the region. So this is a trend that's been increasing in recent years, and probably will keep going into the future.
Yeah. In talking with the people involved for putting your story together for the Times Online and in print here this week, did you get any indication that they're actually doing many of these procedures, or at least talking with people and getting procedures lined up now, or is this something that they are working on that they'll have more and more available here as time goes by?
It just started, so I don't think there have been very many as of yet, but... Mm-hmm. you know, they were just announcing that this is available and you know, let people know about it. So, you know, women in the area who are having a, you know, high-risk pregnancy and can talk to their doctor about, you know, getting this service done locally.
We're talking with Giles Bruce with the Times of Northwest Indiana, who covers health care issues for the newspaper, online and in print. One of the other stories I know that you worked on this week, Giles, is interesting in the fact that we always see doctors involved in clinics and in physician practices and hospitals and the like as a group. But we have some doctors that want to go it alone, and there are interesting ways, I guess, that doctors can do so. And you mentioned in one story about how a Maryville physician is doing that. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so this physician from Maryville, you know, he wants to remain an independent doctor, and that's becoming harder and harder to do nowadays because of, you know, all the overhead costs, whether it's, you know, dealing with all the different insurance companies, and there's also this trend toward so-called population health management where insurers are basically paying doctors like a set monthly fee to take care of a person's health care needs. So then, you know, then if they're able to keep them, you know, from needing too many services or keep them well, then, you know, the doctors will make more money. But, you know, this requires a lot of coordination and data gathering and, you know, paperwork. So, you know, so many doctors now, that's why they're joining hospital systems, because the hospital systems can provide all of this, you know, administrative type work. And, you know, but there are some doctors who still want to remain alone. So recently there was this business that started in Chicago called Village MD that partners with these doctors who want to remain independent. And they provide these different tasks. You know, they provide care coordinators, you know, who are people who, you know, kind of look through what patients might be falling through the cracks. You know, they might be need to come in for a screening, an appointment, and they'll contact them and make sure they come in. And they'll also follow up with patients who might have just, you know, gotten out of the hospital to make sure they're taking their medication and doing care and, you know, things that doctors didn't typically do but are now expected to do, kind of with the way healthcare is going. So, you know, so this doctor here was happy to join the service and be able to remain an independent physician and kind of focus on what he does best, which is the clinical care.
Yeah, it's understandable because doctors are doctors. They're trained. They go through all these years of college as well as internship and training otherwise to be physicians and not to be bookkeepers. And they kind of have to do it as a reluctant side task as well too. Or that's why we see that practices end up having a lot bigger staffs, because they have to have all these people do all the paperwork and everything. And it's difficult enough to be able to deal with Medicaid and Medicare, especially with the system as it is, and now with what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act or whatever comes next for it, it'll be interesting to see. And so it's interesting that we have this one doctor involved, the first one, I guess, from what I understand, here in Northern Indiana, that's involved with this Village MD.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, and I wouldn't, you know, be surprised to see more doctors doing this, because you know, some are still reluctant to be, you know, employers of employees of hospital systems or part of larger groups. They kind of like the freedom of being you know, independent and being able to run their own practices. But that's, you know, becoming a lot more difficult to do. So this is a, you know, a trend that'll continue, and this is a unique avenue for those, you know, doctors who want to still go it alone.
And finally, Giles, we're coming back around, I guess, to talking about prenatal management of healthcare. There was a woman in Hobart, who that had maybe passed away not long ago, and she's found, I guess, probably a creative way to deal with her loss by helping other parents as well. Tell us what that's about.
Yeah, this is a woman named Michelle who I met her doing a previous story, but you know, her daughter Juno was born without a heartbeat in summer of 2015 in Northwest Indiana. So, you know, it was essentially a stillbirth, and you know, she was obviously devastated by this loss. But you know, but at the hospital, she didn't get too much in the way of support, and you know, they essentially gave her a list of funeral homes, and you know, she was home a few hours later, and she just felt like she didn't get a lot of closure. And then there was another woman Amelia from Valparaiso. She runs a group called Emma's Footprint. So the two of them were put in touch. Someone suggested that Michelle reach out to Amelia for support, and you know, that got Amelia thinking of ways that she might be able to help women in similar situations. She went through a similar loss, and the first story I talked to them about was they provided these devices called cuddle cots to Northwest Indiana hospitals, and these are devices that you know, when a baby is stillborn, it preserves the bodies for up to 3 days, so the family has time to grieve and perhaps take pictures and just you know, mourn the loss rather than being rushed right out of the hospital. But you know, after all that happened, Michelle decided to do more, and she did some training and became what's called a bereavement doula. And she works now specifically with moms who are having having a baby after losing a previous baby. So this is what they call a rainbow birth, mm-hmm. kind of a birth after a storm, so to say. You know, and she supports these moms and dads, you know, through this, you know, kind of difficult pregnancy with a lot of anxiety. And what brought this story full circle is that she recently worked with Amelia, who had her and her husband Joe gave birth to twins. You know, and this is after losing their daughter Emma a few years back. So, you know, they had a lot of, you know, anxiety going into this, and were nervous. And Michelle was there to support them through the process and kind of work with the providers at the hospital about, you know, being sensitive to their needs, you know, because of what they had been through previously. So just a, you know, nice story in a way. Yeah. She's, you know, used her loss to do good for others.
On the story, too, looking at the version on the Times website, talks about Amelia and Joe as well as Michelle. Amelia and Joe, after their loss, created Emma's Footprints, and there's a link in the story to that site. And also, too, if you go to Michelle's situation, she founded a group called Juno's Promise. And if you get to the online story, you can get to a link that'll get you to her Facebook page, or you'll get into the Facebook page once you prove that you're not a bot, you know, that you're a real person. And you can find out more there, too. So there's some interesting ways to deal with that as well, too, that people are certainly very, very sympathetic about the problems of stillbirth, and these things, they happen, and that it's pointless to figure that you can't do something about it, even though maybe you couldn't physically do anything about the passing of a child. And certainly if you had a difficult pregnancy, at best to deal with that is kind of the very, very sad climax to that. It's a way to help deal with it and help other people as well, too. We're talking with Giles Spruce, who covers healthcare issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Some interesting stories that you can check out online and in the print version of the Times as well, too. And Giles, as always, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about them here on the show today.
Yeah, and thanks again for having me.
As we continue with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking, it's time to check out news in LaPorte County. And the big news, of course, is going to be what's happening tomorrow, Friday, in the city of LaPorte. In the late afternoon hours, a citywide Republican Party caucus will be getting together. And those members of the caucus will be listening to people talk and making a decision as to who is going to be the mayor of LaPorte for the next 2+ years. Now that Blair Milo has stepped down to take a position with the Holcomb administration. With us to talk about this important topic coming up, starting off with this caucus tomorrow, we have John Gard, who is a reporter for the LaPorte Herald-Argus and the Michigan City News-Dispatch. And as always, thanks for joining us, John.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Nice to talk with you.
Well, you get to spend a lot of time talking about the process here. What is this GOP caucus going to be all about in LaPorte tomorrow evening? What, start about 5:30 or so?
Yes, 5:30, and it involves, there are about 20 precincts. There are 20 precincts in the city of LaPorte, and precinct committeemen, Republican precinct committeemen representing each one of those precincts will vote for the next mayor, to decide who will be the next mayor, and it'll be a vote just among those 20 or their proxies. So it's a very select audience.
Now, in following through the story here, ever since the announcement, not only of Blair Milo's own announcement, but of course the involvement with Governor Eric Holcomb in her taking this new position that he's created down in Indianapolis, the process, I guess that's actually got the machinery going to be able to get this caucus started. What has to be set up here, as far as you know, to be able to get to the point that we're going to be at now at Friday afternoon at 5:30?
Yeah, it's been a hectic couple of weeks, I think, for some of the party leaders, and I don't know how much advance notice some of them had, but the mayor made her announcement just about 2 weeks ago, and mm-hmm. and candidates have been lining up ever since. I think there are eight that will be candidates, so they've got to spend time getting their platforms together and lobbying each one of those precinct committee men for if they're going to have a shot at completing the last 2.5 years in the mayor's term.
That's an interesting role to be in, I guess, as a, for a precinct committee person, if you've been lucky enough and you've been able to go on in your way and help support the party, regardless of whatever party it is that you belong to, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in this very important decision-making role, even though you have, like I can say in this case here, about 24 people involved in this process in LaPorte, but just the same, they don't go do this every day, so they have to be, I guess, probably schooled as well, too, in how to deal with this.
Yes, and I think you're exactly right. It's an otherwise thankless job. You know, you attend some more or less social events, maybe, but when there's a vacancy of an elected office, something like this, it takes on a very important role. And one of the party chairman mentioned that they're going to be some of the most informed voters that any of these candidates are ever likely to encounter, because they each one of the candidates is talking with them directly about what they represent and what their vision for the city over the next 2.5 years.
Now, of these eight candidates, it's got a very wide range of experience and interest and certainly a dedication to the city of LaPorte. Tell us about the people that are going to the committee meeting and putting their name in the hat, so to speak. And as you say, they're, I guess, debating pretty much, I guess, although it's not really a debate, but they certainly are going to have to spend a lot of time explaining things to the committee people tomorrow night. Tell us about the candidates.
Yeah, it really is. It is a very varied field of candidates. There's the former mayor. There's a couple of sitting councilmen. There's one man who is a city chamber of commerce employee, actually, but a member of the current mayor's board of public works and safety, and a couple of people who were relative newcomers who really just wanted to throw their hat in the ring and get to know how the process works, I think.
In fact, we'd like to have had a chance to talk with Paul Boardman, who is probably one of the more prominent new candidates, so to speak, somebody who's not been involved in politics very much, at least in LaPorte, but is a recognizable name in LaPorte, probably as much as, or maybe some people at least, more so than the former mayor, Lee Morris. So these people are going to be interesting. We had a chance to talk with Paul on the air here just yesterday.
Yeah, and some of these folks are—they're well known in the community because they've held prominent positions and they're community leaders. And Lee Morris certainly would be, high on that list of visible candidates. But of course, it all comes down to personal relationships and how individual support. They don't need to appeal to a broad audience of voters. They just have these 20 precinct committeemen to get support from, and some of them who have been in party politics for a long time, they clearly have a better shot, I think, at gaining that support.
Yeah, when we talk about having to go out and lobby and talk, certainly in this case they're lobbying with the precinct committee men and women to be able to come up and at this the caucus tomorrow evening show their support and get show the other people that you're interested in having them as well too. And I guess it turns out, I guess, and doing a little bit of math, my producer D. Dotson said that they are going to need a majority vote of 11 of the 20, or 11 of the 20 people that are going to have to be supporting one candidate or another, won't they, to be able to say you're going to be the next mayor for the next 2 years or so.
Right, and in fact, several of the candidates. Four of the candidates, I believe, are also precinct committeemen, so they'll certainly be voting for themselves, at least in the first round. And the way it works is that the candidate with the lowest number of votes after each round drops out of the race, and then there's another round of voting until one candidate finally has a majority of the votes.
So there's the very real possibility it's going to be a very long evening on Friday night.
It could be. It could be. It'll be interesting to see how it all pans out, because once you drop out, then, of course, you throw your support behind anyone else who you might favor. And there's I'm sure there's a lot of bartering going on right now about how that might play out.
Now, how would it look for the rest of, since you represent, I guess, in a way, as the reporter covering this for the newspapers, representing the general public, or being their eyes and ears in this particular event coming up on Friday, what is this going to mean for the community of La Porte here, regardless of who is chosen? Is it going to be a case where you find somebody that's going to take established practices and policies and feelings about the community and put them in place, or will have some really new innovative ideas?
Well, there certainly have been some candidates who have said that their mission, if they're elected mayor, will be to keep the team together. Paul Krentz is among those. Mark Krentz, rather, is among those. Mm-hmm. There's one group of candidates who really want to see the mayor's vision realized and to continue the work that she's started. And there are others who really, I think, would like to make some specific changes, although they've all expressed support for the mayor. She's seen as someone who's had quite a bit of success in the community.
I guess, yeah, Paul Bortman, I think, is one of those. He has some very definite ideas, and he's taking experience from outside the community as well as his family's generations of experience in La Porte, and I guess trying to turn that into something as well, too. I know, and we talked in the conversation yesterday in particular about the problems that are very commonplace in La Porte, the fact people are concerned about the loss of businesses, and in particular, individual small businesses are disappearing, and just down to just a few big box stores in La Porte, where you have to go out of town to shop and things like that. And he mentioned about wanting to see opportunities to get local businesses reestablished or established in La Porte to kind of help build the business base back up.
Yes, and we'll see how well he's been able to communicate that or convince some of the precinct committeemen that he is the person to do that, to bring a fresh infusion of investment to the community. It'll be interesting to see how well that his message translates.
Well, now, John, we're going to give you an opportunity to toot your own horn, so to speak, here, because I know you're going to be keeping a very close eye on this entire caucus on Friday evening, getting ready for Saturday's newspaper, and I'm sure you'll have something updated online as well, too. What do you tell our listeners who will be looking to the Herald Argus website and checking out the information? How are you going to be able to keep the latest postings up so people will know what happens, and then expect a more comprehensive story the next edition?
Yeah, I have to tell you, I've never attended a caucus election, so this is new to me too. And I know there are caucus elections now and then, but I don't know how frantic it is or how smooth it will be. I do know that the intention is by the party is to elect a mayor and then to swear that person in on the spot. So.
Wow.
It'll be started and completed all by tomorrow night. So we'll just have to see how it plays out and post the information when we can and as we can.
John Gard is reporter for the La Porte Herald Argus, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch, keeping an eye on what is happening at the choice of a new mayor in La Porte. And John, as always, thank you for spending time with us here on Regionally Speaking today to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. On this reporter roundtable Thursday, it's time to take a look at some news here in Northwest Indiana from Sarah Reese, who's reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we're talking with her from her desk at the newsroom. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's take up one of the stories first here, the big event here involving East Chicago, the visit this week by a member of the Trump administration, Ben Carson, coming in. I guess another visit for him. Tell us what Secretary Carson had to say and why he was in East Chicago.
Well, he said that he had read about Chicago and heard about it, but he wanted to hear firsthand from the affected residents. So he visited, and he had a meeting with residents. It was not open to the public, and there was a press conference right after where Carson and other public officials spoke, and then outside, the residents who had been in the meeting met with reporters afterward.
We know that many residents are obviously still very, very, very concerned about the situation in their community, in particular the people who lived in the Calumet housing district that are basically that they haven't moved out. There's still some there, and I know, and I know there's still, I guess, thoughts by the city administration of tearing down the complex. Has Carson offered any help or at least any comments that he would like to see done here to resolve the situation?
Well, he did speak about, you know, that he recognized that especially children and looking out for children, vulnerable children, is important. I would say that I think all the residents have moved out now from the complex, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are still people living in zones 2 and 3, but that's not a public housing complex in those zones. So
it's just a concern. In those cases, those residents who happen to still be in the same district, which is very close by, obviously. Yeah.
Yes, except many of them own their properties rather than having public housing.
So they're stuck with the problem of having properties that would be very difficult, if not impossible, to sell or hand off, I suppose.
Yeah, many of them have said that they've seen their property values decrease over the past year. But as far as Carson, you know, he said that while he understood there had been problems, the relocation, I think he said, I'm trying to remember, I think he described it as went well. Outside residents took issue with that. But he did talk about the importance of tracking any affected children with elevated blood levels as time goes on over the long term.
We're talking with Sarah Reese with the Times of Northwest Indiana. And this, Stacey, we're talking about the story that she wrote. It was in the print as well as online about Ben Carson's visit to East Chicago this past week here. You mentioned in your story as well, to kind of give an update here on the situation with, I guess, the EPA and of course, the visit back in April of Administrator Scott Pruitt, looking into the Superfund sites issue, which has, of course, been the crux of all the problems in East Chicago. Your story tells us about kind of an update here. What is the latest that you have heard about that?
On the EPA side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the latest from EPA is that they have they've spent about $35 million so far, and they've had incurred in costs at the Superfund site, and they don't expect Zone 2 to be done until possibly 2020. Zone 1, the site of the former public housing complex, is really still up in the air. HUD has to sign off first on a demolition plan, and EPA is currently reevaluating its options for cleanup. It's called a feasibility study. After that, they have to go through a whole new process of taking public comment and presenting a proposed cleanup plan or a record of decision. So it's unclear when they may finish the cleanup, you know, across the whole Calumet area.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories that you've had in here this week, we're talking about here on Reporters Roundtable, is the first of the stories that we've seen come out concerning the Pierogi Fest trademark. And you had one of the initial stories about that. If you will, tell us a little bit about how Pierogi Fest seems to have gotten into the news beyond what the city of Whiting does to promote the event every year.
Well, it was brought to our attention that the Edwardsville, Pennsylvania Hometown Committee had filed a preemptive lawsuit because they had received correspondence from the Whiting-Robertsdale Chamber of Commerce. When I talked to Thomas Davertine, he's the chairman of the Pierogi Fest here in Whiting, he said that although we've had Pierogi Fest since 1994, the chamber has held trademark rights since 2006. And when you obtain trademark rights, it's an expensive process, and you have to protect them. So that's what the chamber, he said, was doing.
Do you think these folks in Edwardsville, Pennsylvania, just had no idea that that Pierogi Fest was so important to the city of Whiting that they'd put a trademark on it?
You know, I'm not sure. I did notice in the story from the paper in that area that they felt like they used the word festival, not fest, and that they felt like it's kind of a generic term. So,
well,
I'm not sure.
not to the folks in Whiting, Indiana. No, that's not a generic term. Far from it. It's very, very important. Well, it's interesting. What does it seem, I guess, the next step to be now? I guess it's in the federal courts now, and I'm sure that a judge is going to have to call hearings, and it's going to have to come up for review sometime, I would imagine.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not clear on exactly when that might happen, but it's going to have to make its way through the court.
Have you heard anything lately from the Whiting Robertsdale Chamber of Commerce about all of this?
I haven't, no. Joseph Pete wrote a story over the weekend about it.
Well, it'd be interesting to see what happens there now. We haven't heard if there's if any kind of court hearing date has been set. I'm sure we'll find out more about that. So as many things develop as they come up like this, we'll certainly be back in touch. We've been talking with Sarah Reese, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about a couple of the interesting stories that she's had in the newspaper in this past week. And Sarah, we thank you as always for joining us here on Regionally Speaking. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, it's time to check in with Greg Tejeda with the Post Tribune. He covers news generally in the city of Gary. Greg, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
More about your story here, I guess, concerning bidders that would like to do a study of that ruins of a church, which has now picked up a big award from the Knight Foundation.
We have the old City Methodist Church. Dates back to 1926, one of those classic old Gothic buildings. But it's been sitting there totally empty since 1975, and the city, quite frankly, is trying to figure out the best way to use what would otherwise just be ruins. Mm-hmm. They've got this idea, since it's already in many places, the roof has collapsed, a lot of plants and trees are growing inside. They're going to enhance that idea. They want to develop it into a full-fledged garden. You know, people could go in there, admire the plants, admire the classic architecture. It could be quite an unusual site, you know, if handled properly. And right now, they're in the process of trying to figure out just how sturdy this building is. Because after all, it was closed as a church back in 1975. It sustained some serious damage in a fire back in 1997. So yeah, right now, it's not in a shape where people could just easily wander in and out. And in fact, one of the biggest problems city officials have is vandals getting in there. Mm-hmm. And trying to do more damage. So right now they're looking for an architect who can do a study to tell them just how sturdy the remains are, what would have to be done in order to pull off an idea like this.
Now, what kind of timetable has the city set up for somebody to come in and do this study?
They're probably going to be awarding a contract to an architectural firm, possibly later this month, maybe next month.
Mm-hmm.
And this study would be sometime during the autumn, and we'd probably get some results back in the spring of 2018.
So it sounds like it's going to be a very, very interesting project. Once they realize how much work has to be done, though, and then I guess what will probably happen then, they'll have to come up with the funds to go beyond, of course, the grant that they've gotten from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation to begin with, I guess, to actually get the work done to do what they want to do, won't they?
Exactly. I mean, I've been told this could be like at least a 5-year project, you know, mm-hmm. overall. Wow. It could stretch out even longer, depending on how the fundraising efforts go.
Mm-hmm. One of the other topics of stories that you covered we want to bring up, too, speaking of bidding and the bidding process in this case, is what is planned to happen out at the Gary-Chicago International Airport for what is to be a new customs and immigration enforcement facility out there. Tell us about what they like to do out there and how the process and finding somebody to do it is going to go.
They have a building out there where they used to store the fire department used to store their emergency equipment at the airport. They want to convert that into a customs facility, and a design has been approved for now. Now they're looking for a company that can oversee the actual construction of it, and that's what they're accepting bids for at this point. You know, trying to get a company who could, if that company wants to come in and build the thing themselves, or if they want to subcontract it out to smaller firms, they're in the process of trying to see if this thing can get built, and possibly construction could begin by sometime early next year, mm-hmm. possibly. However, the key to there is, as I'm told by airport officials, that when you deal with the federal government on something with potentially the national security like customs, there's a lot more extra inspection levels that have to be complied with. So ultimately, this is going to be the federal government telling the city when they can move forward.
I understand that from the airport authority officials that they've been very keen to try to get this project going because they see a real benefit to having a better or certainly a full-fledged customs enforcement facility out there at the airport.
Well, the way things are right now, if somebody were to land at the Gary Airport and need to clear customs, they would literally not be able to leave the airport grounds there. They'd have to be bussed by federal officials to a customs facility, possibly at O'Hare Airport, have to clear customs there, then would have to be transported back to Gary before they could be allowed out to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
It would just be a lot more convenient for people if they could do it all in one facility and could attract help more business for the Gary Airport if they could offer the customs service.
We're talking to Greg Tejeda with the Post Tribune, covers news in the Gary area. And another story that that you had online as well as in print in the Post Tribune recently was some work that the Gary Redevelopment Commission is doing, I guess, involving some demolition projects. Fill us in on that, if you will.
Demolition, you know, they're always... The Redevelopment Commission is constantly trying to tear down decrepit buildings in Gary, hoping they can clear space for future development. In this particular case, there was a couple of projects that were bidded out back in 2016. And it turns out the amount of money that had been agreed on wasn't quite enough to cover the cost of the demolition projects. So they had to come back and approve a supplemental agreement to make up the difference that the companies were paid for their work.
Mm-hmm.
But then the state, in the form of the State Board of Accounts, came back and told Redevelopment that they didn't like the idea of those separate agreements breaking this up into pieces. They would have preferred that the city approve one agreement for the total amount. Therefore, the city had to come back recently and approve new contracts confirming the amount of money that was already paid, basically to clarify the keep the books straight and keep the city in compliance with state regulations. You know, city officials insist that they're not paying more money to these companies for work that was already done. It's just a matter of keeping their books straight.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we'll see what comes about if that actually gets taken care of, to be sure. One of the other projects here also involving money in the city of Gary is I understand, a new and separate fund that's been established to cover the expenses that Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson incurs. Tell us about that.
Yes, just this week the Common Council approved this measure. There are times when the mayor of Gary, she does quite a bit of traveling. She does quite a bit of work on behalf of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the other groups, civic groups, and they have her travel and they pay for her expenses. But there are times when, just as a practicality, she has to tap into the city account to come up with the money in advance to cover the expense, and then those groups reimburse her so she can reimburse the city. But technically, there was because of the way things were structured, when those groups would reimburse, their money would have to go into the city's general fund where it gets mixed in with other money used for daily government expenses. And creating this new fund is now something by which these groups can pop the money into that fund, and it can then the mayor can then tap into it for the travel expenses she incurs.
Mm-hmm. That's going to be probably especially important here probably next year. I understand that she's picking up an interesting title of being in a national position with the mayor's organization, so she's probably going to be doing a lot more traveling, I suppose.
Most definitely. And the mayor insists that in a perfect world, these groups would pay the expense themselves for those travel, and the city wouldn't have to be involved in it, but it's just a matter of sometimes it's just easiest if she can tap into the city credit card, so to speak, to cover the expense initially before the inverse.
Well, Greg, one of the last stories we cover here on our opportunity to talk today is the news about a plans for a new port out there by Buffington Harbor, and something that in turn might pick up some additional economic development business for the city of Gary. Tell us about that plan.
Well, the key is to realize the city isn't necessarily interested in getting into the business of running a port, although they do have a little one out in Buffington Harbor, and this could benefit that facility, help it expand a bit. But there are certain tax benefits that port districts are entitled to. So what the city is hoping to do by declaring the entire city a port district, they'd be able to apply those tax businesses to anything that wanted to come to Gary, and they're hoping this could be yet another tool that could help them attract business to the city. Now, this can get complex, and in fact, that's why just this very week, earlier this week when the Common Council met, they actually postponed action on this, and it's going to come up again on the 22nd of August when their Finance Committee meets. They're going to keep hashing this issue out to make sure everybody understands.
Yeah, this does sound rather complicated here. It's, I guess, not anything unlike a tax increment financing district that's a lot smaller. We're not talking a citywide TIF, but we're talking about something that's probably just about as complex, I would imagine.
Exactly. You know, the city officials want to make sure they get this thing right. They don't want to screw it up.
It's too important and too complex to try to mess up, to be sure. And the city of Gary is, of course, continuing to do their digging out financially and economically, so they want to be sure that that the right things are done the first time around, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
We've been talking with Greg Tejeda, who covers news from Gary on the Post-Tribune, not only online, of course, but in the print as well. And Greg, thanks for being with us again today on Reporters Roundtable Thursday to talk about your stories, and hope to be able to check back in with you real soon.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore for some news of the community as well, too. Speaking of staying with Gary, I guess, in this respect, a Gary community company is being recognized for longevity and for success. Powers & Sons Construction Company is being recognized by Black Enterprise Magazine as the 2017 Company of the Year. And our Stephen Lattimore took a look at the Gary company that is being highlighted in the national publication as being the best in the nation.
His father, Maimon Sr., began his career in Natchez, Mississippi, building homes and churches in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Like so many others, he brought his family north for the promise of a better future. He settled in Gary and for 12 years worked for Andrew Means, building projects like Means Manor. In 1958, Maimon Powers Sr. started Powers Construction. He partnered with Holly Winters. And in 1967, he branched off and founded Powers & Sons Construction. The first major commercial project was the Salvation Army at 11th and Grant. Their resume also includes the Railcat Stadium in downtown Gary.
Yeah, it was a great project, a great opportunity. Probably wasn't our most challenging project. You know, there are projects that you do along the way that really make a difference, and certainly that was a great opportunity. Probably our most challenging project was building the tunnels at O'Hare. If you recall how O'Hare is structured, there's a parking garage and there are tunnels that go from the parking garage over to the terminals. But we had the opportunity to build one of those tunnels for pedestrians and for mechanical purposes. And that was probably clearly our most challenging project at that time, and maybe even still today. And it was a real learning experience for us. That one jumps out, the convention center, our first convention center in Indianapolis. It was about 160,000 square foot addition that we were able to build for the city of Indianapolis. We actually had the opportunity to implode Market Square Arena. Implosion is when you demolish a building by dynamiting it. And so we learned the process for implosion and how that all works, and making sure that when the building does collapse from the explosion, if you will, that it actually implodes and goes in rather than out.
More projects followed, each one of them a monument to his family's entrepreneurial spirit. Maimon Powers Jr. was lucky to have a good example set by his father and others.
I was always around African-American entrepreneurs. Literally, our father never had a job. He always was in business or was a vice president for Means Developers, and I watched Andrew Means as a builder build subdivisions that people were very proud to live in the 40s and 50s, and got to learn later on how he accomplished that, because to be able to accomplish that feat when most African Americans couldn't get mortgages, and how do you finance the land to be able to make all this happen, the genius that it took to accomplish that is really quite amazing. It's quite a story how he was able to make all of that happen. And so I marvel at how they accomplished things with much less opportunity than we have today. And that always became my motivation, that they did more with less, and what's your problem? Why can't you do more with more? And so that became my motivation.
Today, Powers & Sons Construction has 70 team members in offices in Indianapolis, Chicago, and here in Gary. Since 1974, Powers has been on the Black Enterprise list of 100 top black businesses in the country. This year, they've been named the Company of the Year. To put it into perspective, it's kind of like being featured in Ebony or Jet magazine for African Americans. It's a confirmation that you've made it.
So I think they perhaps looked at that longevity and decided to select us as Company of the Year for 2017. So it was a total surprise when they called and said that they wanted to bestow that honor upon us, which was one that it is a great honor. And again, we were just totally shocked. Because again, when you're in the midst of just trying to run a business and survive from day to day, sometimes you don't think about what others see on the outside.
Chuck Hughes is executive director of the Gary Chamber of Commerce.
Where African Americans lived in Gary at the time, the more prominent areas were built by Powers and their partner Winters. So they've been around for a long time. And they've won various other awards as well, but to be designated as Business of the Year by Black Enterprise, that's a huge accomplishment. And they have been a company that we have pointed to for a long time because they've hired a lot of local people over the years, and they've been a source of pride to us in the community.
Over all these years, Powers has learned some tough lessons, like how important it is not to grow too large too fast.
I think the biggest mistake that I've made and others can avoid, it gets back to what I talked about. One, stay focused on what your business objective is. Don't think that you can be everything for everybody. So if your mission is to, as I said, build houses, you know, stick to building houses and make sure you build them well before you start to do something else that's different. And you'll get tempted, and we get tempted all the time, to look at other opportunities outside of our core business. And I've just found it's better to stay with our core business. Once you have a little success, don't let that success go to your head, because you can be history just as quickly as you can be be deemed successful.
So what does the future hold? Well, the next big project they're hoping for will be on Chicago's South Side, and it bears the name of Chicago's favorite son, Barack Obama.
Well, I guess I can say at this point probably the most exciting project that we're pursuing right now is the presidential library, the Obama Library. Yeah, that's probably the most exciting thing that we're pursuing. So it's in the very early stages, but it is, I guess, public information that we are, along with, you know, we put together a team to pursue that. And I know there's nothing that anyone else can build that we can't build. And so we've tried to impart that same type of motivation and passion with them, that anything anybody else can do, we can do, and we're just as smart as they are. Matter of fact, we're probably a little smarter, so because we're still here.
In Gary, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released a long-awaited report not long ago that says new measures are needed to prevent Asian carp from getting into the Great Lakes. More on this now from Great Lakes Today's Elizabeth Miller.
The report analyzes three ways that invasive species like Asian carp enter the Great Lakes: swimming, fishing, or hitchhiking. The recommended plan would keep an electric barrier near the southern tip of Lake Michigan and blast noise there to bother the fish. There would also be water jets designed to remove small fish and boat launches located upstream and downstream of the Brandon Road Lock and Dam. The National Wildlife Federation's Drew Youngdyke says the Army Corps' $275 million plan looks promising.
When they use those different technologies, each one may have some weaknesses that are covered up by the other. So it looks like they're kind of making them run a gauntlet where even if they can make it through the first one, that second one's going to keep them from getting through.
The report was originally scheduled for a February release, but the Trump administration delayed the release amid concerns from legislators and members of the shipping industry. Illinois Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti says Monday's report will hurt the Illinois economy and its commercial navigation industry. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Great Lakes Today is a journalism collaborative of public radio stations in Great Lakes states. That's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And once again, thanks to reporters Giles Bruce and Sarah Reese from The Times, from Greg Tejeda from the Post Tribune, and from the Herald Argus and the News Dispatch, John Gard, for being our reporters telling us about their stories today on the program, and Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore as well, too. I'm Chris Nolte. We will be back with you with a new Regionally Speaking program on Monday.